Labor and Commerce Committee. I'm Senator Mia Costello, and with us today we have Senator Meyer, Senator Gardner, and Senator Hughes. Welcome, our Vice Chair. Also in the audience, we are welcomed by, or we are joined by Senator Begich. Thank you for attending. I really appreciate it. So the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee has been having several meetings about the economy. It's the first time that we've had a dedicated slate of economists come before us last week, and we've gotten some really great information. And we're going to continue looking at the economy this week with some representatives from industry. So we know that Alaska is in an economic recession. Again, that's a first. It's the first year since 1988 that our economy is not growing every year. So the question, how does what we do affect the economy, is a really significant one. I just realized I failed to mention that it's 1:34, and it's also January 24th, 2017. And our recording secretary is Carrie, and our LA operator is Kyle. Thank you. So back to Alaska's economy. We've heard from economists about the recession and what can we can expect, that we won't be pulling out of it anytime soon. So it's really important that we as a legislative body look at how our actions affect the economy. So today we have the tourism industry. Thank you for being here. The air cargo industry, and we're also going to be hearing from the health insurance industry on what we can expect moving forward. Specifically right now, we are joined by the President and CEO of the Alaska Travel Industry Association, Sarah Leonard, welcome, and Colleen Stevens, who is also a small business owner out of Valdez and also a member of the marketing board that governs the helps set the stage for where we what we do with those important tourism marketing dollars. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to you, and feel free, members, to ask questions during their presentation.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for committee members for having the Alaska Travel Industry Association here. I'll briefly just talk about ATIA, the association, and then move into travel trends. The Alaska Travel Industry Association is the leading statewide membership trade association. We are over 700 tourism businesses strong, members strong, including tourism businesses representing different sectors and regions of the state. Our members are bed and breakfast and lodge owners, tour operators, transportation organizations, small and large cruise ship companies, and community convention and visitor bureaus like Visit Anchorage, Explore Juneau, and Discover Kodiak. Last year, with support from the governor, the state's marketing program was transitioned to be managed by the ATI team. Our team connects our tourism members and businesses to the various cooperative opportunities within that program, and we support our members with tourism education and networking opportunities. Overall, our goals are to provide the most efficient and effective marketing resources, professional development opportunities, and advocacy statewide for our members, and to promote Alaska as a quality tourism destination. Most of our members are small to medium-sized businesses or organizations. The majority of our membership, or 73%, have less than 20 employees, and almost half have less than 5 employees. Our members range from businesses like Salmonberry Tours in Anchorage to the Best Western Kodiak Inn and the Palmer Museum and Visitor Center. ATI has a 24-member board of directors and a team of 7 staff. Our current board chair is Dennis McDonald from Alaska Coach Tours. And here today, Madam Chair mentioned, and also part of our board's executive committee, are Colleen Stevens and Deborah Hansen in the crowd. They're ATIA's government relations co-chairs. Colleen owns Stan Stevens Cruises and Tours out of Valdez, and Deborah works for Pike's Landing in Fairbanks. I was invited to share with you Alaska travel trends. I'm going to start globally and then work our way back home to Alaska. Employment worldwide in the travel industry was forecast to grow nearly 2% in 2016 and have a continued rate of a 2% increase into 2026, directly accounting for almost 136 million jobs worldwide. The World Travel and Tourism Council points to the 1.2 billion international travelers who have visited global destinations in 2016. And by 2026, they are predicting this will be nearly 2 billion travelers. They attribute this to the world's population growth and predict within 10 years, 25% of the global population will travel internationally. As recent as 2015 numbers report, travel generates positive economic impact nationally. In the trillions generated for the U.S. economy, the billions of dollars spent by travelers, and the millions of jobs that depend on travel. In Alaska, that translates to 47,000 peak season jobs, over $4 billion in economic activity, including $1.4 billion in labor income. This growth has had an upward trajectory because of past strong investments in tourism marketing. We've seen this healthy job growth. Alaska's tourism industry is a renewable natural resource, and we want to remain a healthy industry contributing to budgets in Alaska. That includes the family budget, generating billions in economic activity, which supports local Alaska's businesses and providing the opportunities for them to hire more Alaskans. It's providing revenue to city and borough budgets to the tune of over $80 million, which supports community services, and to the actual state budget in over $100 million. This is positive impact for Alaska based in part, as I mentioned, on healthy investment of tourism marketing dollars in past years that's been supported by legislative leaders. Alaska has had a competitive destination marketing program, and we have seen a record number of 2 million visitors to our state in 2015. That summer was a 7% increase from the previous season. The majority of Alaska visitors are summer leisure travelers coming by cruise and then air. And with competitive marketing program attracting these millions of visitors, they are spending money on a wide range of activities, from lodging to gifts to transportation. It's across the board and benefiting many different types of businesses. Initial indicators for 2016, this past season, show increases in travel. We saw a 3% increase in cruise arrivals. Again, cruise visitors typically account for just over half of Alaska's visitors in a year. And last year, Alaska welcomed its 1 millionth cruise passenger to Juneau. That hasn't happened since 2009. Personal vehicle traffic crossing into Canada from Alaska was up 14% in the summer months, May through August. And outbound employments, or people leaving Alaska, including residents and visitors combined, was up 3%. I'm on page 13 for those following the presentation. The Alaska Marine Highway is perhaps still seeing the impacts of ships out of service and scheduling changes. We know they're going through a strategic planning process, and their traffic was down 9%. International air was up 4%. These exit numbers, it's important to note that international travelers are also leaving via domestic air and through other means, and the research, the Alaska Visitor Statistics Program that accounts for this data, does not consider or considers Air North and Air Canada as domestic. So this might be a conservative number.
Sarah, I hate to interrupt, but I do want to recognize that Representative Chris Birch is also in the audience, and thank you for joining us.
On page 14, here's a little more detailed look at sector trends, starting with cruise traffic. Our partners at Cruise Line International Association Alaska are forecasting another uptick in cruise visitation in 2017, including the redeployment of a Howl America vessel to Alaska. And we see this modest 3% increase in outbound domestic air from last season. This is after a huge jump in 2015 at 11%. And we see international air travel increase from a dip in 2014 and 15 and from a high in 2013. We've seen good partnerships with China Air, Japan Airlines, Condor. However, with no more resources towards these markets, we can't predict what will happen in future years, as we are unable to build these partnerships and hopefully provide more access to Alaska. On slide 17, the green slides are Canadian statistics, and the dark green is U.S. statistics. And previous years were kind of flat with the border traffic between Canada and Alaska, with little dips and increases. We've seen a jump in the last couple years, perhaps due to continued low fuel prices. These positive economic indicators are due in part, we believe, to a competitive destination marketing program for Alaska. Our marketing strategies to attract visitors to Alaska are built around the fact that we are more like international destinations than U.S. states. Marketing strategies are often for us take years to realize because it takes time for a visitor to plan and visit our state. I'm going to point out another trend for Alaska tourism and how it impacts the economy, the decrease in statewide destination marketing funding from the state. During the last legislative session and following governor's vetoes, tourism marketing funding from the state was reduced from $4.5 million to $1.5 million. As legislative leaders, you also included language in the budget requiring the tourism industry to come back to you with a plan to reduce reliance on state general funds. This $1.5 million appropriation is a significant decline from years past when stronger tourism marketing funding levels reached into the $10, $16, or $18 million range. The flip side of this trend is our competitor destinations are increasing their tourism promotion levels at the same time ours are decreasing. As you can see, our funding falls well below states like Arizona, Virginia, and Arkansas. We are number 49 in terms of budget levels. Only one other state is lower than us. That's Washington State. We realize this is a mixed message. The tourism industry is healthy right now. I've just shown you really positive economic trends, and which we think will continue into 2017. However, while we compete with many of these other domestic destinations, I'll mention again that Alaska requires more investment because we are a long-haul, exotic, and still safe destination that takes time to plan a trip and visit. Alaska's marketing strategies have focused on these attributes. We are seeing the years of healthy investment in dollars in the marketplace for our marketing strategies to work and to realize those economic benefits. As we experience reduced destination marketing dollars, we fear this will affect our share of the market. And it will reduce the impact and the number of visitors we are able to attract, generating less spending, less economic impact in 2018, 19, and beyond. We've also seen trends nationally, the impacts of reduced statewide tourism marketing dollars. Case studies show when destinations reduce their marketing dollars, they lose market share and revenue. These case studies show that in 1993, Colorado repealed their tourism funding and with 2 years lost 30% of their U.S. visitor market share. Conversely, during a recession, the state of Michigan doubled their state tourism marketing funding. And those of us in the tourism industry remember it was an award-winning campaign called Pure Michigan to attract visitors to their state. From those years in the slide, they generated $6.6 billion in visitor spending. Pennsylvania's tourism funding declined 77% from the years 2008 through 15. They projected a loss of $600 million in state and local tax revenue that travelers would have generated. In 2013, the city of San Diego held off on allocating tourism promotion funding for marketing that destination, and they projected during that time period $560 million was lost in visitor spending and $24 million in reduced tax revenue. The ATI Board of Directors, along with industry leaders at the Alaska Tourism Marketing Board, and I'll stop here and thank both Senator Hughes and Costello for their participation on the Alaska Tourism Marketing Board. This group held several meetings since the last legislative session, researching and discussing different revenue options as we worked to meet the legislative mandate. The board kept focused on these guiding principles. Any new funding solution must be broad-based, not reliant on one industry segment or funding source. And revenue should focus primarily on visitor activity with the least impact on Alaskans. A plan would package new revenue with existing revenue from the current vehicle rental car tax collected that can be allocated for tourism promotion. These conversations gravitated to one concept for funding destination marketing called tourism improvement districts, and this slide is a very simple slide in how a structure around a TID might work. Tourism improvement districts have occurred around the country at local or regional levels and in California at the statewide level, where industry pays an assessment, it's collected by government, It's funding allocated to tourism promotion. It's governed by those who pay, managed by an existing nonprofit or industry association. And much like the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute assessment model, that payers can vote to disestablish the assessment. We continue to share this concept with an industry and have presented a funding plan to the legislature just today around Alaska destination marketing based on this TID concept. Finally, I'd just like to close with some general trends in travel that can be connected back to a destination like Alaska. The Adventure Travel World Summit was held last year in Anchorage and attracted 700 to 750 tour operators, media, and others coming to Anchorage. And our partners at Visit Anchorage provided a statewide experience for this group and highlighted Alaska as an adventure travel destination. We are seeing increases in multi-generational travel, where more and more families and grandparents are bringing their grandchildren or families and on trips to celebrate milestones, birthdays, or anniversaries. We're also seeing continued increase in popularity in culinary and tasting tours, which highlights local foods and goods, new breweries. Travel shows are incorporating food and culture and have raised awareness, again, around this type of travel. We may continue to see increase in highway travel if price of gas remains low. And there's an increase in Chinese visitors, in particular students living in the United States who are visiting all over, and particularly in the Arctic, in Alaska. They have a great interest in Northern Lights and Aurora. And as they're taking trips, they're sharing these stories and information back with families back to China, which is a huge growing market for all types of travel. ATI has also been involved in discussions on tourism development in the Arctic, and the Arctic remains a hot topic worldwide. Our industry believes there is value in statewide destination marketing for Alaska. We believe this because we see revenue generated from tourism-related activities contributing back to communities. We know maintaining a competitive marketing and brand is crucial to capturing market share domestically and around the world. We see these positive returns in infrastructure, revenue to local governments, and jobs, which are benefiting Alaska communities and Alaskans. Our Alaska tourism industry may be more of a shining light in our economy now, today. We want to be part of the solution and remain a healthy industry supporting Alaska jobs and Alaskans. Thank you, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you very much, Sarah. I really appreciate you presenting. I know you presented this morning also in the Senate Finance Committee meeting, and I was able to sit in on that. And that meeting, you presented the industry's plan to assess yourself, which is the first time are asking that you've done that. So I really want to say we appreciate that, to be part of the solution as we move forward. My question has more to do with the economic impact that tourism has on the state. And we know we're in a recession, and tourism is one of the bright spots, as you had mentioned, in our economic landscape. As we look at the level, of what you've done with the money that you did receive, is there a time period that's a lag between the investment where you can see a downtick in the number of visitors based on maybe 2 years out from a low marketing year, or is it 2 years out? And are you preparing for a year in the future where we will see fewer visitors and then therefore fewer dollars in our local economies and fewer revenues coming into the state? Or are you hoping that this plan will actually sort of bridge that level of more austere marketing budgets?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will say we can't predict that lag time. I think there's a real fear as we see other destinations. We don't want to be the next case study in a slide. And definitely that conversation, we educate our businesses about more and more as I'm presenting around the state, or our board members, we're talking to our member businesses about the low resources and destination marketing, and we're hearing from them how that's impacting their own business. Mm-hmm. I can't predict when it's going to happen, but I think that we've learned, or we're seeing, again, from places around the country, and we fear that that could happen to us, and then Alaska will see reduced economic activity. But also, I think it'll and Colleen can maybe address this, we'll see it more anecdotally or one-on-one with individual businesses who are experiencing less visitor traffic or who can't make a new investment in a boat because they can't leverage their marketing dollars with a statewide program. They can't do it on their own. Where our cruise partners certainly benefit from a statewide program, but they have millions of dollars in a marketing budget and are able to continue marketing and partnering with us. Where I think businesses or Alaska will see this impact is, again, with individual businesses, and again, if it's appropriate, let Colleen speak to that, and also in the general economic activity that Alaska will see with reduced visitors coming to Alaska.
Senator Meyer?
Are you ready for
Well, I actually was going to allow Colleen to respond to that, and also if you could share with the committee, do you know the gross the percentage of the state's gross domestic product that is brought in by the tourism industry? What percent do you contribute? And if you don't know the answer to that, if you could get it to us.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Colleen Stevens, we will most certainly find that answer for you, because I don't think either of us have that in our pocket right now. And just to elaborate on what Sarah was saying is, our large corporations that participate in the tourism industry in Alaska do have the deeper pockets than your smaller businesses that are mostly Alaskan-owned. And as one of those businesses, I think our fear is there is a lag, typically. So a year or two down the road, our 2017 is looking strong right now for many of those businesses. But it's the outreach of the state program to the independent traveler, to the one that gets to the smaller businesses, the ones that get to rural Alaska, that's the place that our current program is going to have less communication capabilities. And so our goal would be to close that gap as quickly as we can. Of course, we'll be looking to you guys for leadership legislatively to be able to keep the funding levels for marketing program as high as it's possible over the next year as we work to have a TID in place to be able to do those collections. So there is a partnership that we're going to be coming in and hopefully working with you all to be able to bridge that gap the best we can.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Sarah. Colleen, is it? Yeah, thank you for the presentation. So the TID, I think, is a great idea, and thank you for coming forth with that. Is there a bill in progress?
We have, Matt, through the chair, Senator Meyer, we have draft legislation, and we could be ready to move forward in the next week and sharing that with legislative staff or leaders to move that through quickly.
Okay. Yeah, no, that's good. I think it is something we should have before us to sooner rather than later to evaluate and hopefully move. The chairman was asking about what the economic impact is to the state of Alaska, because we frequently hear, well, we don't get much money from tourism at the state level. Most of it is at the local level, which is, because, you know, we obviously care about our local areas as well. Do you have, like, a ballpark number? I know, like, cruise ships, we get the head tax. That's probably about $50 million, and car rentals probably $10 million and $10 to $12 million. Is it $100 million? Is that safe to say money that's coming to the state?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, that's the number that we promote, that through visitor taxes and fees like the vehicle rental car tax, various bed taxes there's no statewide bed tax, obviously, but through corporate tax, fish and game fees, we talk about $100 million that's contributed to the general fund through visitor-related activities.
Obviously, if we can get them to buy a beer and a pack of cigarettes, that helps too a little bit, I guess. last week we were looking at various taxes and what impact that would have on our economy, and obviously sales tax is one of them that we discussed quite a bit. And if we had a statewide sales tax and you have this many visitors coming up, that would be quite a bit of money to the state of Alaska. Then I think, you know, that number would go up substantially, obviously.
Through the chair and Senator Meyer, and we also look at messaging and how we can be accountable to that. If we have a healthy investment in marketing dollars and are attracting those visitors to grow that pot, I think exactly what you're saying, so that visitor contributed economic activity can grow because we are marketing to them. That's a positive cycle.
Mm-hmm. And then, Madam Chair, one more question.
Senator Meyer?
There's a lot of different marketing of the state of Alaska. You mentioned the cruise ships kind of do their own, but they're obviously marketing Alaska. And I know you and I both live in Anchorage. ACVB, Anchorage Convention Visitors Bureau, has a pretty large marketing budget. And, of course, they get their money from the bed tax. And I think Fairbanks and, I don't know, maybe Matsu and Juneau, they all have their own local marketing groups. Do we coordinate efforts so that we maximize that marketing dollar?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, we do. We partner with exactly those organizations. Where ATIA is managing a statewide program, we can provide statewide representation and attract those visitors to Alaska. And then we support those organizations in highlighting their amenities and attractions particular to their community, to attract visitors once they get here to visit their region or community. And we are constantly working together. There's sectors represented and regions on the Alaska Tourism Marketing Board that help guide the marketing program. They're members of ATIA, the association. So we have really good partnerships with many, if not all, of the destination marketing and management organizations.
Great. Thank you.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I have quite a few questions, and some of them are pretty short, and some of them may be more involved. So just stop me when somebody else is ready.
Feel free.
Okay, first of all, we've seen a lot of state budget cuts over the last few years, and I've heard anecdotally about impacts from reduced airport hours. I've had people contact me and complain about highway restrooms not being maintained in the level they're used to. We heard about when some of the ferry runs were canceled and people had paid. I mean, hundreds of people had booked trips. And my understanding is those are the independent travelers who actually tend to bring money to different levels of the tourism sector than the big cruise ships do. Do you have any data about the impact of cuts and how it affects tourism? And, you know, part of my concern is that as we work with our budget and it see it sort of squeezed, we want to make sure that we do no harm to those industries that are healthy and kind of part of our hope for the future. So do you have any actual data on how budget cuts have impacted tourism?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, I think that what we're still seeing is the positive impacts of past healthy tourism budgets. Mm-hmm. And we can't predict what will happen in 2018 and 19 because of those cuts. We fear that with cuts in destination marketing, that we'll see less support or less community services to be able to support those infrastructure, roads. If we're not attracting visitors, for example, and paying the vehicle rental car tax, and some of that money goes to support state parks and roads, that pot also goes down for all of us.
Right.
And so we would advocate or promote that with the help us, give us the tool to assess ourselves so we can continue to grow the pot and have a healthy industry. We also don't want to be an unhealthy industry. We want to continue to be the part of the solution and contributing to Alaska and local and state budgets.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I might follow up. So,
Senator Gardner?
Probably the most directly impacted in the short term are the communities that were affected by the ferry cuts. And that's for some of their internal, you know, their local use, but also tourism. You haven't heard from those people?
Through the chair. We did do, when Marine Highway schedules started changing a year and a half, well, more drastically a year and a half ago, the association, ATA, did do a survey of members who were impacted. So it is not necessarily scientifically collected data, but it's anecdotal data as to what their impacts they were seeing from their individual businesses. And that was shared with operations staff, I believe, at the Marine Highway, and so that they knew what some of those impacts that the industry was seeing.
Would it be possible for us to get that data, too? Thank you.
Thank you. And before I go to Senator Hughes, I was wondering, there's a slide in here where you show the marketing dollars, and I was wondering if you could also update that and provide information on the amount of revenue that the industry brought into the state those years, and also the number of visitors that we enjoyed those years. So, and Senator Hughes.
Thank you. First, I want to applaud your work, and particularly on the TID of stepping up to the plate. And I'm glad Senator Costello had you move to that slide, because I was wondering, with that arrow going down, and we talked about the lag time, have you teased out the impact of television shows about Alaska on the tourist industry, and are you monitoring that? Do we know, is that also on a downward trend? Is it, you know, it was kind of a hot thing to have Alaska shows. I'm not much of a TV watcher. Or are those continuing at a pretty good level? And do you feel that that has helped? And could that possibly, if they're going to stay at a good level or possibly additional shows, do you think that might help us with that lag?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes. I get that. That's a really good question. I get that question a lot, and when I talk about the tourism industry, and I think there's still a lot of reality shows out there. I would love to have the research dollars to be able to answer that question and know what the impact of those shows are on raising awareness about Alaska. One of the challenges is we haven't had the resources to do that type of specific study, and that those marketing messages are not controlled by, we don't manage them or control those marketing messages. And often, I don't watch those shows a lot either. I have maybe a couple favorites, but they're often not authentic Alaska stories. And so if we're trying to promote Alaska as a quality destination, there's a little bit of a rub there. They certainly do raise awareness around Alaska. I will also say there could be have been a decrease in them as the film office closed 2 years ago. So that industry is no longer receiving investment or credits to bring new projects to Alaska.
Senator Hughes?
And changing the subject a bit, when we talked about the economic activity of about a little over $4 billion statewide impacting family budgets, about $100 million to the state, as we discussed, and then close to that, 80-some to local municipalities. What's the geographic distribution of that? Is most of that Anchorage, Juneau, and then tied into that, this uptick in Arctic vacation kind of things, are we going to see any of that economic distribution significantly impact any rural communities, and if so, which ones?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes. It does kind of spread from South Central to Southeast, where there are more visitor product, there are more businesses concentrated in those regions, the economic activity. But even in places like far north or southwest Alaska, where we see a low percentage, those are still large dollars for those regions that are lessly populated. So where 1,500 jobs means a lot to southwest Alaska, that would be a really low number for southeast Alaska as far as the visitor industry. So it does kind of fall in visitor impact from South Central, Southeast, Interior, Southwest, and then Far North. And I can get you those specific numbers of what that means in millions of dollars. And what was the second part
about
of your question?
The Arctic. Yeah, the Arctic.
We have seen growing interest in the Arctic with new cruise ship, small cruise ship itineraries, and also as those avenues open up. I know from attending cruise gatherings with cruise ship companies, what I've heard of is that they've worked really hard to partner with the communities that they may visit or impact with their visitation in their itineraries. And so I would hope that there would be we'd see some positive economic impact in those communities that they are able to visit. In some cases, in the Arctic, in Alaska, I won't speak for the entire Arctic, some communities aren't ready to host visitors, and so that may determine where those cruise ships are able to visit. But we continue to be part of those discussions so that those partnerships can happen and that when those itineraries or experiences do happen, that they're benefiting appropriately Arctic communities.
And a follow-up, yeah.
Senator Hughes.
And it sounds like those conversations are just beginning, and we're at the very, just at the on the edge there to get going. When do you think that kind of Arctic vacation kind of thing will be at full throttle, when we might expect some economic benefits?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, the first cruise ship was a year and a half ago, or the Crystal Seas, I think, that went through Arctic waters. I see it as continuing to grow. We can build that, that's a good suggestion, build that into our existing research program, the Alaska Visitor Statistics Program, to be able to capture some of that data and see what kind of impacts that they're having.
If I may, Madam Chair, the other
Colleen.
Thank you. Through the chair, the other aspect to the Arctic is not just the water access side, and I think we'd be remiss to not say that right now our operators that are operating north of the Arctic Circle, they're busier months are right now. They are seeing large peak, many Chinese travelers, but also domestic travelers that are, you know, sometimes starting their vacation in Fairbanks and enjoying the Arctic and North on land programs right now. And some of their operation seasons literally are having higher volume now than they do sometimes in the summer.
Mosquitoes.
And Senator Gardner, did you have a comment?
Mosquitoes.
I wanted to wrap it up then with, I guess, a point that falls in line with Senator Hughes's question, which was, are you involved with helping those communities that might see new tourism visitors to their communities? Are you helping with that? So on Thursday, the committee is going to be hearing from the local regional economic development organizations. They're called ARDRs. And we're also going to be hearing from the Department of Commerce and asking the question, as they have been asking the question, should Alaska have a statewide economic plan? So I'm encouraged to hear that you are starting to have those conversations, and certainly on Thursday we can ask the ARDR specifically, have you considered tourism as part of your regional economic development plan? With that, Senator Gardner?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have other questions. I'll try to tone them down as quickly as I can. One of them, and this is sort of a burning question to me, in thinking of the TIDs, what is the benefit of having it collected and processed through the government? Can your members not simply contribute to your functioning, and then you don't have to worry about who's making the decision and governing who pays and how it's spent? It's all up to you, no?
Through the chair, Senator. There, as you look at TIDs across both local and the state example of California, there are some which utilize the government as a partner for collections, and there's some that are private, and I think that is one piece as we go down working on legislation with you all as partners that will be in the discussion piece in the table as we look at that.
Thank you. I'm still curious to see what the benefit of it is for you.
We are an acronym-free zone, and so I have let you off the hook, but for those listening, TID is a tourism investment district. Thank you. So with that, I want to thank you for being here, and certainly if any members have questions moving forward, I'm sure we can pass them on and we'll get the answers to you. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
We'll take a brief at ease for our next presenter, John Binder, with the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, the Deputy Commissioner, and also Commissioner Lucan. You're welcome to come forward, too. Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is called back to order. And with us now, we have John Binder, who's the Deputy Commissioner of Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Thank you for being here. Just to put into context why we've invited you, so we're looking at industries in Alaska, sectors of the economy that are thriving and doing well, and asking you what it is that is working. And so you're with, of course, the State Department, but we're talking specifically today about air cargo and the impact on the economy, and any thoughts that you have about moving forward in a recession environment, how we can keep air cargo strong and thriving, if there's any high points or areas of concern. So with that, thank you for joining us. And again, I want to mention that Commissioner Lucan is also here listening, and I appreciate you being here also.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to get to be in front of you today. Yes, Alaska International Airport System, often referred to as AIAS, is thriving. It's an interesting dichotomy in that when oil prices are low and the state budget is hurting a bit, air cargo and airline traffic is doing well due to low fuel prices. So that has certainly benefited the international system. Previous speakers gave a pretty good overview on the passenger side of things, and certainly tourism industry has a huge impact as well on airport traffic there, so I will kind of gloss over some of those things in my presentation, but you'll see that we've benefited very well as well from the state's tourism activity. I will kind of throw out an overview related to the airports in the state. The Department of Transportation does operate and own 242 airports in the state. Two of those are Alaska and Fairbanks, or Anchorage and Fairbanks Internationals. Those are split out separately as an international enterprise system by statute. They're required to be self-sustaining, so no state funds go to those airports, and no funds and revenue come from the airports back to the state. The remaining 240 airports we refer to as our rural system, often referred to as statewide aviation. While today's presentation is focused on the international element, there are several of the pieces of our overall airport system that are really intertwined and linked. So you will see some references throughout the presentation today on our rural system as well, some things like cargo and passenger traffic. Obviously, a lot of what comes to Anchorage and Fairbanks comes in through that rural system as well, so they benefit each other. Our department's mission is to keep Alaska moving through service and infrastructure. You'll see that we have international and rural mission statements there as well, with the international primarily being focused on the business side of things and being a thriving enterprise there that keeps the economy active in the state. On the rural side, we're more focused on maintaining the standard of living and access to communities out there that most of which are not connected via a road system. On the international side, our big goal there is to be a model government agency. Sometimes that's a challenge. There are very few airports across the country that are run by the state government out there, so making sure we're a prized place to work, being proactive in our customer and business engagement out there. And again, that's another challenge sometimes, is being under state government there. Core values, if you've dealt with the transportation side and the commissioner sitting in the room, you hear our integrity, excellent, and respect often. The other piece we add to that on the international side is the enterprising. We're going to be real engaged with our carriers and our businesses out there to make sure that we're constantly growing. I mentioned the structure here. Again, it was created by statute out there, so those work together. We do refer to both of them then collectively as the international system. Again, they benefit each other. A lot of the reason carriers come to Anchorage is because they have Fairbanks. They're available as a ready alternate in the case of bad weather or volcanoes or whatnot out there. So they really do work together for success.
Mr. Bender, I did want to ask you a question about the management and oversight of the airports. So you had mentioned there's a separation between the state and then the enterprise system that is basically governs the international airports, Fairbanks and Anchorage. Is there any oversight board or any particular group of people that help advise the airport directors? Or I guess where I'm going with this is the Anchorage International Airport, Ted Stevens International Airport, is in my district, and I do get constituents who are concerned about issues about communication, and they have questions about that quite often. And so could you touch base on that, on how this management structure works in terms of your interaction with the community?
Sure, Madam Chair. As far as the overall leadership structure, obviously I'm Deputy Commissioner, so I serve as Executive Director for the International Airport System. The respective airport managers in both Anchorage and Fairbanks work and report directly to me. Otherwise, they have complete control in the operations of their respective airports. As far as the public engagement piece, there's a couple elements of that. The governor has an aviation advisory board made up of stakeholders from around the state representing the different stakeholder groups. There's ones representing the passenger airlines, cargo airlines, regional airlines, communities, unorganized boroughs. So some of those different aviation groups out there provide avenues, air carriers as well, all have avenues then to me and the airport managers as far as the public engagement piece. Other than that, since we are under DOT, we are driven by the Administrative Act as well, so all of our public engagement include hearings, public notices, all those kind of standard things as well.
Is it your opinion that that process can be improved? Or are you happy with how it's working?
Madam Chair, I would say I'm overall happy with how it's working. I think communication is one of those things we can probably always improve. I don't know that you can do too much, but finding that balance between staff effort and resources available to improve that versus making sure the message is getting out and you're getting proper feedback, I think we're at a pretty good balance.
I actually would be interested in making any improvements to that, just in terms of outreach to the local community. So if you at some point wanted to visit with me to talk about that, I'd be very open to that. My office has pursued different options, and I think that it might be time to look at how to give more confidence to those neighbors who live near the airport and are neighbors to the airport. I mean, I know that you bring you send individuals to the community councils, which I think is really important. So I appreciate what you are doing, and I'm just always trying to take it one step further.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to discuss further. This slide directly just indicates the benefits of location, location, location. As far as the globe goes, Anchorage and Fairbanks are accessible within about 9.5 hours to 90% of the industrialized world, and that's one of the big reasons air cargo takes such advantage of our location as well. Another benefit from Anchorage and Fairbanks, the fact that we have a mountain range between the two means that neither airport has ever been closed at the same time there, except for the 9/11 exception there, which we obviously didn't have any control over. But even things like volcanic eruptions, weather events, all those kind of things have not affected both at the same time, which has been a real blessing. As far as an economic engine goes, we generally advertise that Anchorage Airport there essentially accounts for about 1 in 10 jobs, both directly and indirectly, with in Fairbanks about 1 in 20. You'll see it's almost $1 billion in payroll there in the Anchorage area, a little bit less than that Fairbanks-wise. Both airports continue to thrive really well economically. A lot of that is fed by the regional impact as well, and our statewide airport system out there. Obviously very little of our state is accessible by roads. We advertise that 2% of our communities are not connected to the road system there, so almost completely dependent on aviation, at least for year-round type service for goods and services. Mail, passenger freight, all that stuff passes out to those areas through Anchorage and Fairbanks as well.
Mr. Bender, are there any changes at the federal level that are impacting our ability to access the local airports? And specifically, I have heard just through conversations, I'm not certain, which is why I'm asking you the question, and I appreciate you being here, perhaps requirements about weather reporting stations or any kind of FAA changes that will impact cargo delivery to those communities that really only have that as a main driver to get goods to the community.
Right, Madam Chair. A couple elements of that. You mentioned the weather reporting stations. That continues to be a challenge. When you look at the density of weather stations in the United States compared to what we have in Alaska, a pretty significant difference. So that's something we're always engaged with the FAA on, striving to get more weather reporting systems up here, just providing safer service primarily and more consistent service for the carriers. Other big piece you mentioned is the freight, and this slide kind of shows it up there too by mail. Most of the freight up here, and certainly all the mail does, is part of the bypass mail system, which is a program the U.S. Mail Postal Service has that allows direct shipping to some of these places, bypassing the actual post office. Really provides improved rates and whatnot for our rural Alaskans. Because of the cost of that program, and Alaska is not the only benefit of it, but is the primary user of it, that continues to be highlighted at the congressional level and is always subject to cuts on each annual appropriations. So that's one I think is probably the highest risk out there, that we're always staying engaged with our congressional delegation and the FAA as well, and DOT, making sure that program is preserved.
just to summarize, then you're not aware of any changes on the horizon or changes that we've had recently to requirements that would affect access to those communities?
No, Madam Chair. Okay. That is a correct statement.
Okay, thank you.
As far as economic contribution out there, most of the economic studies we have are kind of in the 2009 to 2012 time frame there. We're in the process of updating those, but at that time, aviation accounted for approximately 8% of the gross state domestic product, about $3.5 billion. And again, see the advertisement there, about 10% of the jobs in the state can be directly or indirectly contributed to aviation. A little bit on the two airports. Anchorage has three runways out there. I'll get a little bit more into the cargo piece of it there, but the 60 wide-body parking positions, when we talk wide-body, those are the large 747 Boeing 777 aircraft you see out there that dominate the air cargo industry. ILS that allows them to get right down to the runway, 24/7 operations out there, lots of fuel available, an in-ground hydrant system, which is certainly beneficial, especially during weather events. Anchorage continues to get recognized for its performance, primarily in snow removal areas, as you can imagine. We've also been recognized as number one for air excellence for 5 years in a row. That is an award given by the carriers themselves as they fly around the world. So we're pretty proud of the performance they do. Another key stat you see there is number two in North America. We're also number four in the world for amount of air cargo that's landed on our runway. So pretty significant accomplishments there. Previous speakers mentioned the passenger side of things. That 5 million represents both getting on and getting off the aircraft there. So that incorporates the tourism industry as well. You see we're getting approximately 70 wide-body freighter aircraft per day. On a given month, almost every single wide-body aircraft flying out there comes through Alaska on the 747-800 fleet out there. So pretty significant stop for those folks. Folks are aware of FedEx and UPS. There are a couple of our anchor tenants there and have been for quite some time. Happy to have them, as well as several of the Asian carriers. Majority of our cargo traffic through Anchorage and Fairbanks are Asian carriers. The Asian economy continues to climb. The middle class there is more and more able to afford products that are made in North America, so that's allowing a lot of good trade back and forth, and we're taking advantage of that. Here's a slide recognizing the rankings. Anchorage was number five last year, past Incheon. Fairbanks, a couple hundred miles to the north. You'll see a slide here later on the Great Circle route. And actually, in a lot of cases, Fairbanks is actually a shorter stop for folks going over the poles there. But certainly a blessing to have that airport available up there. They've got a long runway as well, several parking spots and fueling capability. And everything the folks need if things aren't working well in Anchorage. Mentioned the Arctic and the North tourism industry. Fairbanks continues to benefit from a lot of the Asian charters that are coming over, primarily in the wintertime as well. That continues to be a flourishing market. They're doing a great job engaging with those tourist agencies in Asia and continuing to grow that market. Just a little bit on kind of how the international system runs. There are signatory carriers. When I say signatory, they have signed an operating agreement with the international system. We're currently about 3 years into a 10-year agreement. What that means signatory-wise is that they get reduced rates and fees as far as landing fees, fuel flowage fees, those things that it costs that we charge airlines to operate at the airport. In return, though, they buy the risk of making sure the airport's funded fully each year. We set our rates and fees in order to meet the anticipated budget. If we're a little bit short, then those carriers make up that difference. And if we have a good year, which we've had the last couple years, better than expected, then that capital just rolls over to the following year's operating budget. They do have a lot of say in the budget development, then the ability to veto that development as well to include capital projects as well. So very involved in how the airports run. We meet with them quarterly and do a complete financial review of where we're at. This shows activity over the last many years. You'll see back in the 2007-08 timeframe. That was really the peak. There, we're still down about 20-30% since that time. The important thing to realize that is that this slide is based on weight of aircraft and freight landed there, and as the industry has continued to upgrade their fleets to larger, more efficient aircraft, it takes less aircraft to move the same amount of freight. So the total landed weight has decreased, although the amount of cargo continues to be relatively constant. The big light blue there is the overall cargo passing through, primarily international. The thin dark blue along the bottom, that is the in-state freight. It tends to stay pretty constant there, about 100 million pounds a year. Passenger is the green, and you see the purple along the top there. That's the international passenger traffic, and you see that's really slacked off as well as those passenger carriers have been able to upgrade and improve their fleets to aircraft that can make it across the ocean without being refueled now. So the little slivers you see in these late years, those are the charter aircraft from Asia. We measure our overall activity based on certified maximum gross takeoff weight. That's the CMGTW. That's how the carriers are charged as far as landing fee goes. The red line across the top is the current year there, so obviously doing well again. Last year was the blue. See, it did dip a little bit below the green line from kind of the January time frame on. That was a little bit of a discrepancy. There were a lot of West Coast port issues there in California, Washington, Oregon area that forced a lot of that cargo to be shifted to air as well, and we obviously benefited from that. As soon as those labor relation issues were sorted out, then a lot of that cargo went back to ship. So that caused 16 to be a little bit lower again. Here's just a breakdown of some of the cargo carriers. You'll see that Cathay, UPS, China Airlines, and Korean tend to dominate the majority there, but you'll notice is most of those names are not American carriers there, so certainly represents the Asian influence to our operations. This slide's a good way to show why people stop in Anchorage for gas. You know, you draw the lines connecting Asia and North America, and you're flying right over the top of Alaska, so it definitely benefits them to land. In order to not stop and refuel, they have to sacrifice so much cargo and fly half empty in order to make it all the way. It's much more profitable for them to load up full and stop here halfway and get refueled. Mentioned the importance of Asia to us. You see that almost 80% of all cargo that passes between North America and Asia passes through Anchorage. Majority of our cargo or revenue that is created here is by cargo as well. Yes, there are passenger flights landing. We'll get those here in a minute, but because of the size of the aircraft, they're a pretty small percentage of the overall revenue that the international system generates. Passenger activity has certainly been a highlight. We're up about 4.5% last year, which matches kind of exactly with the numbers the tourism industry shared with you here a few minutes ago. And that certainly accounts for the majority of it. Slightly down the beginning of the year here, but otherwise holding steady. There's a breakout of the passenger carriers. Obviously, Alaska Airlines, especially with their in-state service as well, tends to dominate that market. Here's some of the city pairs we've got serving. You'll see there are quite a few over to Asia, but again, those are all charter aircraft. Those are not scheduled service. The ones crossing over the pole to Reykjavik and Frankfurt, those are scheduled service, but they're only seasonal. Revenue-wise, the international system made just over $140 million last year. Again, the system is not in a profit mindset. The revenue they generate is based on what the projected costs are for that year. You'll see that we did exceed our planned costs fairly significantly there. About a $20 million difference. $10 million of that was better than expected activity. The other $10 million related to revenue that was collected for capital costs, runway improvements and whatnot. And since this is the operating budget, that $10 million of capital costs is not included in there. The other big piece of economic engine-wise that the airport system brings to the state is in terms of the federal funding through our airport projects. The FAA has the Airport Improvement Program, AIP, that brings in about $200 million a year to the state. Approximately $50 million of that occurs at either Anchorage or Fairbanks International, with the other $150 or so out to the remaining 240 airports. Just a little bit of an overview on those. The way that money is determined, several different factors. Airports get it based on how much cargo passes through as a percentage of the overall national total. There's also a passenger entitlement in there, again, based on the amount of passengers compared to the total nationwide at the time. Another portion equates to airports that are not hubs. So that's everything that's not Anchorage and Fairbanks. When you think of the hubs around the state, that you think everywhere Alaska Airlines flies, Bethel, Dead Horse, Barrel, those kind of locations, those receive a certain amount as well. Alaska gets a state apportionment per law. They also get a chunk. We also get a chunk based on just the amount of land and population we have. And then the last bit of it is up to the FAA, really based on priorities they have nationwide at the time. And currently, their priorities in Alaska are rural access and safety, which obviously we can continue to work on. A couple things we've had going international-wise. Mentioned we have a couple studies underway. One of them has been an economic development study. I've been working with Municipality of Anchorage on that one as well. The goal is trying to find different business areas where we can add value to the things that are happening at the airport. You know, I mentioned we have all this cargo passing through, but for the most part, that's exactly what it's doing. It is passing through. So other than refueling the aircraft and helping with the crew change, there's not a whole lot more happening to it. The more we can do to find ways to either bring things together, whether it's through assembling or distribution systems or whatnot, to have more of an impact on that cargo, will certainly benefit the airport and the state as a whole. Figuring out what some of those business propositions might look like and finding the appropriate targets ends up being another piece of that challenge. One we're working on right now is potentially an aircraft maintenance facility as well, as several of these carriers continue to upgrade their fleets with new aircraft coming online. Mentioned that through a given month, most of those different types of fleet types are passing through Anchorage, so it seems to create a unique opportunity for a maintenance facility to see all those aircraft in a given schedule. Constantly trying to look out to the future, again, being business-oriented, having that type of a mindset, trying to figure out what we can do proactively there to not only add value there, but to posture ourselves to be ready for the next change in air cargo and passenger activity out there. That can be a challenge, certainly. So much is dependent on things outside of our control. Really working to partner with state agencies, local convention visitor bureaus, the communities as well, working the tourism piece. Marketing is one big piece of that as well. We're also staying actively engaged with the Asian community. Again, that's the key part of our market, so making sure we're staying in front of them and meeting their needs as well as the opportunities that they see forecast in their own business models will benefit us. Mentioned the strategic plan there. Department's been working on the results-based alignment effort over the last year and a half. That continues to yield benefits across the spectrum, primarily in gaining efficiencies, finding areas where we can improve processes and optimize our revenues. We will have our internal review for that here next week, so looking forward to what new initiatives we might bring out of that. Last piece I'll mention international-wise, a little bit of an outlier is Lake Hood, since that's included as part of Anchorage International as well. Do everything we can to meet that need as well. It's the largest seaplane base in the world with the most activity as well, so kind of a gem in our portfolio out there. It's well used. Master plan process is something that's required by the FAA at least once every 10 years or so, there to make sure, again, you're projecting out what your needs and plans are going to be for the coming years. And we're about to wrap that up.
Mr. Bender, could you briefly talk about how Lake Hood is managed? Is it the same process that you mentioned for the entire airport, or is there more community input in this management of Lake Hood?
Madam Chair, as far as the leadership structure for that, the Lake Hood manager works for the Anchorage International Airport manager, structure-wise. There is a Lake Hood users group. It's primarily made up of the folks that are operating on the lake or have lease agreements with the lake, but they are also involved in the community groups as well. Close with just some of the challenges we see in the future. Hard to know what carriers are going to continue to do as far as fleet changes and upgrades out there. Looks like most of them are about done with their wide-body conversions for the most part. Both airports are fully outfitted to handle any of the aircraft that are on the market at the time. Within the state, Alaska Airlines is bringing 737 freighter aircraft online and getting rid of their combi aircraft. So it'll be interesting to see what that does to the freight market within the state, as well as the passenger market. They're already investigating some other areas where they're not currently operating, so that will be interesting. Climate change, I put that one on there because we've seen some milder winters here the last few years, which brings a lot more freezing rain, icing events out there, which is very expensive to deal with in the terms of the manpower required and the chemicals and whatnot to melt the ice during those events. Another piece on our rural system is erosion out there. We're seeing coastal erosion there as we see more of these winter storms, in cases where there's not ice pack where there used to be. And another piece is the permafrost there is continuing to thaw up north as well, which is making some of our airports' runways less stable than they've been in the past. And we're always working with our federal agencies, making sure we have a good relationship with them. Locally, our local representatives on those agencies tend to be pretty understanding and seeing where the challenge we're facing working for us. But getting that message back to D.C. can often be a challenge. And I'll close with that and certainly happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you again for being here, Mr. Bender. So we're focusing on economic development and the economy as a whole, and I know that Alaska Airlines announced that they'll be building a new hangar, which is a $40 million investment at the airport. Are there other good news on the horizon that you know about that you can share with the committee, or how are you actively trying to grow opportunities at the airport?
Madam Chair, yes, that's the big one, and then they're also investing pretty heavily in their terminals around the state as well. I believe it's approximately 10 terminals that they're upgrading to around the state, so that's certainly been a huge benefit, or will be, to those communities, and certainly shows Alaska our airlines commitment and investment in the state. As far as what the state is doing as far as encouraging opportunity, primarily getting the word out that we have land available. So much of that is dependent upon the economy in the local areas, in the communities, what opportunities are available there, but then working through our leasing agencies, leasing folks to make sure that we can execute agreements and help folks take advantage of opportunities they see.
Any other questions from committee members? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. On page 24, you mentioned under the revenue that landing fees made up 47% of your revenue. And I think you said a lot of the international flights like to land in Anchorage to refuel. The governor has proposed changing the aviation fuel tax. Do you think raising that the fuel tax would have an impact on how many of these international flights would actually land in
airport, or would that make any difference at all?
Through the chair to Senator Meyer. At this time, as written, it would not affect international carriers. Current state statute has international traffic exempt from the state fuel tax, so any of those flights that either originate or end the destination in another country are exempt from the fuel tax. So as written, no.
Okay. And then to follow up on the landing fees, if I may.
Senator Meyer?
Sure. Do we get landing fees from all the airports? Because I think you mentioned there's like 242 rural airports. Do they all pay a landing fee?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, no, they do not. Right now, Anchorage and Fairbanks International are the only ones that charge landing fees for the state-owned aircraft. Ketchikan and Juneau and some of the local, airports run by the local communities do charge landing fees, but not at any other state-owned airports.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I may.
Senator Meyer.
So I think last year you mentioned that the task force, or somebody mentioned the task force, had recommended increasing the aviation fuel tax instead of the landing fees. Is that still the position?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, that is correct. That was the discussion last year. The governor had asked us to review various revenue generation opportunities, and we worked together with the Aviation Advisory Board through some of those options, and the board's conclusion at that time was that a fuel tax was the most equitable way to collect revenue on the aviation system. The board is still reviewing the current proposal. In fact, we meet tomorrow as well for further discussion. So I won't speak for them yet on what their recommendation will be this year, but I can say that in general, the board feels, again, the representation of those various stakeholder groups, that a fuel tax across the entire aviation industry is the most equitable way to collect revenue.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to get off into a finance or budgetary, because you want to stick this strictly to the economic impact to the state. And I'm just not sure what impact that would have if you started charging a landing fee at, say, all the airports, because I'm assuming your largest cost for maintenance is probably in the rural airports. You mentioned a lot of erosion and climate change, I think, is what you said. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Senator Hughes, followed by Senator Gardner.
Yes, thank you for the update. It's been good to have you here. Just wondering if you're hearing anything coming out of Washington, D.C. You know, the new administration, the president has talked quite a bit about transportation infrastructure upgrades, and he specifically talked about airports. And just wondering what you're hearing, and if funds did become available, whether you're looking at where they might go as far as in the world of airports in Alaska.
Sure, through the chair, Senator Hughes. We have not heard anything specifically from the FAA different from what you might have heard news-wise. There certainly is a hint potentially at an infrastructure stimulus of some sort. As far as where those would be directed on the aviation side of the house, we certainly have many years of airport projects in line needing funding. So we already have a prioritized list for addressing many of the needs across the state should those funds become available.
Senator Hughes?
A follow-up. That list of priorities for projects, is the economic benefit part of that prioritization project? In other words, especially when we're in a time of recession, if we were to receive funds, it seems like plugging it in somewhere we would have the greatest economic benefit would be wise. So is that prioritization involve economic benefit?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, we use a criteria as far as scoring projects, which then places it in a prioritization list. Economic benefit or impact is one of those criteria. That said, when I mentioned the FAA's priorities and where they allocate that funding, generally, because of the number of airports we have and the issues we're facing at each of those airports, things like safety and runway structural problems and those kind of things tend to dominate that scale. So if you had a project that was strictly for an economic benefit type factor, that's not going to score well enough to trump all of those other airports we have above for more structural type issues.
I have another question, but I don't know if you want to go on.
Senator Hughes, and just so the members know, Lori Wingheyer, the Division Director of Insurance, is coming up next to talk about health care, and we were hoping to give her about 45 minutes, so just so that you're aware. Okay. Senator Hughes?
Okay, this can be a short one. I understand that maybe all or most of all the iPhones that come into the United States come through Alaska, and I'm just wondering, I'm assuming that those planes are full, whether they're carrying iPhones or other cargo. What's the capacity as the planes are going back the other direction? I know there was a lot of talk about how there's space on some of those cargoes, and we should be thinking about what we could fill those planes with.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, yes, that's a perfect example. Anybody who buys an iPhone and tracks it, you'll see it generates in Asia, and it comes right through Anchorage and goes down to the lower 48 and then comes back to us. So that gets to the opportunity potentially for some sort of a distribution center here that would add value to some of that product. In general, the aircraft coming east are full, and in the past have been partly empty anyway, going back west, again, because of the lack of demand for North American goods. We're continuing to see the amount of space available decrease on those aircraft, so that's good as Asia is able to afford some of those other goods and services, primarily goods. But it also provides opportunity for things like seafood and some of the products that we have in the state here, and how we get the right people talking together so that would entice an airplane, one, to land here, because sometimes they're light enough they can overfly us if they're half empty, or two, every time they open up that aircraft and start adding pallets to it and adding freight to it, that's incurring cost on the carrier as well. So there's got to be enough of a commodity here to make it worth them to open up that aircraft. And we're having those discussions all the time.
Thank you. Senator Gardner?
Yes, thank you.
Are you sure? Okay. Thank you very much for coming before the committee. And with that, I'd like to just go right into our next presenter, who is Lori Wingheyer, who's no stranger to our committee. She's the Division of Insurance Director with the state. And welcome, Lori. She's here to talk to us about the healthcare industry. And I also want to welcome Deputy Commissioner Parity. Thank you for being here also.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, we want to thank you for this opportunity to re-engage with dialogue with the legislature in this current session, and I regrettably want to open the session by taking you back to the close of the last session, the close of the special session, where the legislature wisely completed the passage of House Bill 374 and the ACHEA bill, or the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. In making that $55 million appropriation, the legislature was responding to unique Alaska market forces. We had had our second significant insurance carrier depart our market, MOTA, so we were down to a single carrier. We have had two previous years of rate increases in the 35% to 40% range in the individual market in Alaska. And so the decision, which was not taken lightly, of course, to appropriate those funds, was to stabilize the individual market in Alaska. And we are happy to be able to report to you today that that effort succeeded. The anticipated rate of increase in the individual market at the time that action was taken was 42%. As we went through the rate filing process and the rate review process in the Division of Insurance, it ended up being 7.3%. So as we give you this update today, I wanted to provide that background. There are many questions. We've already encountered questions in Senate Finance regarding the operation of that program, and we'll be glad to answer those questions today and continue to dialogue with you, but I'd like to turn it over to Director Wing-Hire to walk you through the PowerPoint.
Thank you. And for the record, my name is Lori Wing-Hire, and I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance. And as the as the Deputy Commissioner was saying, it's been an active time for us since we left in June, and HB 374 was passed. That bill had two components to it. It allowed for the reinsurance program, which then there was an enormous amount of work in getting the regulations promulgated, the contract or the grant agreement with ACHIA to operate, the administrator of the program. We spent a considerable amount of time doing that, but it has been completed. It is all in, the program is operating. And I think one of the important things that we need to talk about, that there was a little bit of confusion, I think, coming out of that, is the program was intended the fiscal calendar year. Insurance policies run on a calendar year, and the funds were appropriated for a fiscal year. As of this date, there has not been a penny spent of that $55 million because the policies for what that money was appropriated just began January 1st, 2017, even though the funds were appropriated July 1st, 2016. And I think it's important for us to clarify again, because there have been concerns. That money is held by the state or ACHIA until Primera, because they are the only insurer in the market this time, is presented a claim. There's been somewhat of a misconception that there was almost a block grant, for lack of a better word, given to Primera, and that is not the case. When a claim is paid, when someone is diagnosed or is being treated for one of the diseases that we discussed last year, I know several of you were rather involved, Senator Costello, you sat in many of the hearings on this, the hemophiliacs, the cancers and such, Primera would pay that claim. Then it would be ceded to the ACHIA to be, or the Alaska Reinsurance Program, as we now call it, to differentiate it from the old high-risk pool. The claim would be ceded to the Alaska Reinsurance Program. So as of this date, because of if someone treated on January 1st, the claim wouldn't have had been time to process, so it would not even be to the program yet to be paid. That is one of the issues that we need to discuss with you today or want to bring to your attention. When the bill was passed, there was a confusion of or I should say there was a stumbling block on the calendar year and fiscal year. But I want to get to that in the next slide. The Deputy Commissioner has done an admirable job of explaining that the program had an immediate impact. We went from what we thought was going to be a 42% rate increase to a 7.3 average rate increase. You couldn't have asked for a better immediate result when that $55 million was appropriated and HB 374 was passed. It also gave us the authority to apply for a Section 1332 innovation waiver, which becomes important to us for a number of reasons, because at the last minute the bill there was a sunset clause added where the Senate Finance asked us to come for, to look, gave us 2 years basically to find a funding other than coming from the premium tax or the general fund of the state. And we did get the application for a Section 1332 waiver, which will provide, or we think will provide, some funding for this. And as of a week ago, it was deemed complete by Secretary Burwell. So with that being said, backing up a little bit, in this next slide, slide three, this is what the wording you will see in the current budget. And Section 28, to go to the last part first, because that always helps, is repealing what was in the budget last year, taking back the $55 million. Section 10 is then reappropriating the money that was for in fiscal year 17 and asking for an additional $55 million for fiscal year 18, but allowing it to be spent over the calendar year as opposed to the fiscal year when the insurance policies actually run, so that the money is there. It is basically just correcting what we didn't foresee in the closing days of special session when HB 374 was passed. So it's not asking basically for $110 million. It does appear that way. In Section 28, we are repealing the $55 that we were given last year and then asking for it to be given back, but the period for which it can be spent is a multi-year. One of the reasons for that is, as I alluded to briefly, is that if someone is treated December 30th of 2017, that claim will not be paid in 2017. Most likely it'll be paid March or ceded to the reinsurer in March of 2018, and we need to give time or allow time for that claim to be processed, ceded to the reinsurer, and administered correctly. So that's the purpose of Section 10, G and H of the governor's current budget. And I'm happy to answer any questions as we go through this, but it's correcting somewhat the budget from last year when the appropriation was made, and then asking for another $55 million going forward. But I do want to address that $55 million somewhat. This kind of restates again what, but the first one, that should be calendar year 17, not calendar year 18. And I do apologize for that typo on the first bullet. But again, it's we had a struggle with the fiscal year to the calendar year. The policies are a calendar year, and we needed to get that corrected. HB 374 also allowed for us to apply for a state innovation waiver. And they're called 1332 state, Section 1332 waivers, because that is what they are called in the Affordable Care Act. And they are somewhat of a unique animal. There has only been one granted. They were not effective. They were not allowed to be effective until January 2017. To the best of my knowledge, there's only been three that have applied for them. Hawaii was granted one. California and Alaska's were deemed complete. California withdrew theirs within the last week. All of them have been different. California's had to do with immigration. Ours has to do with reinsurance. And Hawaii's had to do with the small group. As you can see on slide six, the description of a waiver, it gives you some ambiguous language. And the language is, as to when you apply, there is no formula. There's no set application. It's in such a manner as a secretary, and that would be Secretary Burwell and possibly Secretary Price going forward, as the secretary may require, contain such information as the secretary may require, but there is no true application as to what you are submitting. So we were kind of going somewhat by the seat of our pants, hoping that we could convince them that our program, the reinsurance program that we're talking about, was going to be a viable waiver. In plain English, what you can waive are benefits and subsidies, the market. You can make some changes to the way you provide healthcare plan choices. You can waive the individual or employer mandate. But you have to stay with what they call the guardrails. At all times during this, the waiver has to be budget neutral. You cannot discriminate. It has to still remain affordable. And the coverage that you offer has to still be as comprehensive, although you are allowed, as I said in the earlier slide, to change it somewhat. So what did our application contain? We did meet all the requirements in going through the federal regs of what the secretary asked us to provide. We gave them a description of the legislation that was passed in 374, saying that the legislature supported the innovation waiver. And we gave them an analysis and an overview of our program. And it's over 200 pages, and I've given you the link at the bottom of this so that you can take a look at it if you so choose. Yeah. We talked a little bit about the HB 374 at the end. Senate Finance asked that it was a two-year sunset, that we find alternative funding to support the reinsurance program. It was Section 6, so we knew we had our work cut out for us. So what was our waiver? And this is probably the important part of this. If you know, those of you that have followed what we have done with the Affordable Care Act in Alaska know that a significant amount of our population receives premium tax credits or subsidies. And those are based on, of course, they receive them based on their income, but the subsidies are based on the amount of the premium. So when we passed HB 374 and we only took a 7.3 increase, and it's still a good increase for anybody who's buying insurance, particularly if you're not being subsidized. That's close to a 10% increase. But when you take that, you only had a 7.3% increase as opposed to a 40% or a 42% increase as we would have. There's a big chunk that the federal government would not have paid in premium tax credits. There's a 35% delta. And in 2018, this slide shows you that our projections, and this is the actuary firm Oliver Wyman that we hired, shows that the estimated premium tax credits in Alaska were $233 million for 2018. With the waiver, there were $182 million. We're asking that the federal government return that $51.6 million to us to fund the reinsurance program. That, in essence, is what our waiver is. It will not all come back, the whole $51 million, which I think the Deputy Commissioner is going to talk about in a minute. But in a simple concept, that was what our waiver was to the federal government. It received tremendous amount of support from CMS. It was written up in various articles, Alaska, the reinsurance bill, the waiver itself, from the Wall Street Journal to the Minnesota, I think it's the Tribune, to we have just received a tremendous amount of publicity over this because it worked so well in the fact that it stabilized our market, and we were not the only state that is suffering from having a lack of competition down to one insurer, seeing extreme increase in reinsurance or insurance rates to the individual market. So we came up with something very innovative in HB 374. We came up with something even more innovative when we asked for this waiver and said, okay, the federal government, you would have paid this money to Alaska consumers if we hadn't done this, so can we have the money? Because the government, the legislature is saying we're not going to fund this forever. So if you give us this money, we're giving you a way to help stabilize this individual market. And it was deemed complete by Secretary Burwell a week ago, which it's the second waiver in the United States that's been deemed complete. So we were extremely happy that we were able to come back and report to you since we left in June that your instructions to find a way to fund this program going forward, we did. The program was successful. It was. And now we're looking at working with the federal government to make this a permanent part, we hope, of the Alaska insurance market. Now,
excuse me, we have a question from Senator Hughes.
So, were you the brainchild of this, Dr. Wingheyer, the 374, and then to request the waiver, just out of curiosity, where it's innovative, it's unique, it's getting a lot of publicity. So was that something you came up with?
Through the chair, I work with an incredible team, including those over in the commissioner's office, and we worked very hard to think of ways that this would come together to work. I don't want to take the credit. It was a lot of us that worked on this.
Follow-up, I think that you're being quite modest. I'm curious, you say the application is complete. That's not a yes yet. You got a nice publicity around the nation. Are you getting good vibes from those that will make the decision? And when might we know whether this $51 million is going to be coming?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, we are getting good vibes. I can tell you, I'm going to let the Deputy Commissioner speak to some of this, but the letter that we got back from the governor, that the Governor Walker got from Secretary Burwell, and what the little caveat was of why it's not approved as opposed to complete. In December, the Trump transition team reached out to us and pretty much grilled us on this waiver and the reinsurance program because they liked it. Now, I don't know that means that it's a done deal, but for them to reach out to us and speak to us about the program, we took as a step in the right direction with the changes that you've heard of, repeal, replace, there's going to be a new bill, there's going to be this, there's going to be that, that they reached out to us to say, how does your program work, how did you do it, what has been the impact, and what do you see going forward? We took that as a positive sign that even with the change in administration, that this program or this reinsurance program and funding from the federal government has a chance of surviving.
And one follow-up. And
Senator Hughes?
Maybe you're going to address this as you go on, and if so, but are we putting all our eggs in one basket? What if this, everything's looking very good right now, but what if it weren't to come through? Then are we back having to come to the legislature for the $55 million.
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, that there's a real possibility in that to stabilize the market.
Mr. Parody?
Madam Chairman, if I could segue from Director Wintire's comments, and thank you, Senator, and I would just note my agreement with
your identification of our lead innovator. If you look at this slide down in, it's too small to read, I'll read it to you. Down in the next to last paragraph, it says, I would note that before the department can approve the waivers, proposed legislation appropriating the funds for the Alaska Reinsurance Program contingent upon approval of the waiver must be created in Alaska. We are exploring ways to articulate some conditional language that reflects, obviously legislature is not going to write a blank check, just as obviously the feds are going to want some reassurance relative to the reinsurance. So we're trying to define language to straddle that. Going to the next slide was from Director Cunahan at CMS, and of course in the transition he is no longer there. But the waiver itself right now is on a 30-day federal public comment period, and there we have initiated a 180-day decision period. So the director and the commissioner are headed to Washington, D.C. for meetings with Senator Murkowski and others the first week of February. And this situation is fluid, and it's going to continue to unfold as you work across the session. The waiver is for a five-year period. I wanted to back up and note in the amount of work that was generated out of our department, our division, and our office, it's 190 pages. It's got a detailed actuarial study to it. But as with anything in insurance in the actuarial study, it is an estimate based on a set of assumptions. And so the table that's before you now, I personally created the three caveats that are there because I want to scramble those numbers so nobody tries to hold them to specificity. They are illustrative. So the caveats say it's a preliminary estimate subject to revision. It's for illustrative purposes only, and I want to just take the top line for 2018 for purposes of illustration. This table combines our Oliver Wyman actuary analysis as well as an ICER economic analysis. The first is column 2 and the second is column 3. What you're trying to estimate is what are the costs going to be and what's the savings to the federal government and what out of that they might be willing to pass back to us. So our best estimate, and we are in the process of updating this work now, is that we might see an $11 million bill to the state and a $44, $45 million cost share with the feds. And the other thing I want to say is I just want to talk about 1 year's numbers, because obviously 2018, 19, 20, 21, 22, it's going to progress over the five-year period, and you're going to true up to your actual experience as opposed to your estimated claims history as you move forward. So that actuarial estimate's based on age, how many people you expect to enroll, what their alternatives are, and in the midst of all this, of course, the Affordable Care Act is being redesigned at the federal level. But in the concept of this waiver, if we just use $55 million for a year, if we got 10, 11 of it back from the feds, and theoretically, your first-year funding might have funded the five-year period. I don't think that's quite fully descriptive because of price inflation, particularly in healthcare, et cetera. But what we're hopeful for is to see some sort of cost-share agreement with the federal government where perhaps 80% of those funds come back to us, 20% remain a state obligation, and we sustain the individual market in Alaska for Alaskans. The legislature has actually dealt with that high cost pool since the mid-1990s. And the core of this is really straightforward. You take the 400 or 500 most sick individuals who can't get buried in a 10 or 20,000 group, and you subsidize those high cost cost codes. But it isn't that you're subsidizing those 500 people, it's the 21,000-23,000 individual Alaskans that are in that market, a third of whom are not subsidized, who see insurance rates that are bigger than their mortgages. And it also helps ensure that we have a carrier available to provide coverage. So we have projections. They're being updated. We will be in a constant dialogue with you and the full legislature over the course of the coming months.
Thank you. And I know, Director Wingheyer, that we spoke last session about the value of the 80, looking at the 80 percentile rule. And I was hoping that you could talk to the committee about just more of a higher level review in the 15 minutes that we have left about how the department's work and looking into that has gone, and for those members who don't know what it is, just what it is, and how in Alaska we can start to get a handle on the rising cost of healthcare, even though it's from an economic standpoint, it is one of the sectors that's growing. However, it's also, as Mr. Parody said, providing sticker shock to Alaskans when we look at the cost of healthcare in our state.
Certainly. We did prepare a couple slides on it. Because the 80th percentile is, it's a regulation, as I think you all know, that was put in several years ago, 2004, which basically said that insurers, if you go out of network to be treated, that insurers will pay your claim basically at the 85th percentile, or the 80th percentile. That has led to when there are very small groups or one or two providers that the, for lack of a better word, that the allegations are that they're setting the 80th percentile and driving up costs of claims. It's been a very emotional topic between the insurance industry and the medical providers, and of course the consumers are kind of stuck in the middle. They want their claims paid, but they also recognize the price that they're paying for the insurance premiums. So it's kind of this vicious circle. If you touch one, which one are you going to touch? Well, earlier this month we held a public hearing. It was a scoping hearing just to take testimony on what people believed the 80th percentile, if it was benefiting Alaskans. We wanted to hear from consumers. We wanted to hear from the public, the good, the bad, and the ugly of the 80th percentile, so we could come back and talk to the legislature about it. The hearings, I think it was January 6th, that was on a Friday. We actually held one in the morning, and we held one at 5:30 in the evening to allow people to come after work. We received over 60 written comments alone that are on our website regarding this, and the hearings were well attended. They were pretty much packed, particularly the morning one. We went over the time allotted for it. And what we came away with is certainly the insurers have a point of view of what they're seeing in claims, that there are certain providers that appear to be somewhat driving the market. But then there is a whole group of providers that are not perhaps term specialists, that when they testify, they are well below the 80th percentile. They're not billing within that. They're charging less than they would pay in New Orleans. They're charging less than they would pay in Seattle. And if you listen or read their testimony, they are struggling to make ends meet. And these are primary care physicians. These are ER docs. So you've got kind of this mixed bag of, you hear the insurers on one part, and you've got kind of a divided medical community. You've got some specialists over here, a small group, and you've got the rest of the market.
So, Ms. Wingheyer, what I'm hearing then is something that we're very aware of, which is a transparency issue and consumer awareness about the cost, so that you can choose to go to somebody that might charge less. Is that where you're headed with this? Is that you think that in addition to looking at this issue, we address the transparency?
Through, Madam Chairman, I think that at some point we're going to have to address transparency. I think that in what comes out of D.C., it may be taken care of for us, and it may not be something that the state necessarily has to request
based on the Affordable Care Act.
Madam Chairman, I also wanted to add is, like with anything that you deal with in public life, there is a range of perspective and opinions. So I've had questions posed to me what does Alaska want its healthcare system to look like? Do you just want to triage and ship people off to Seattle? Do you want to have specialists in Anchorage? There's a cancer center operating here in Juneau now. Where's that balance point between local service providers and efficiency? And that whole gamut is contained within this 80-20 question. You said where were we headed? Transparency is certainly one of the major items under discussion, but the frank answer to your question is we're still trying to sort out the testimony received and come forward with some ideas, which we're developing.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. And thank you very much. I'm kind of wading my way through because a lot of this is relatively new to me. But if the federal government were to pick up the transparency issue and do it in a way that's really effective, what's the fastest we could anticipate that it would come? I mean, do we have a couple of years in which we still have to address this locally?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, I can't imagine that it would come quicker than a year at a minimum. To take a program like that, to implement, to pass the regulations, to get them implemented even at the federal level, to give guidelines, to give rules to which they would have to comply, and allow the medical community the chance to actually implement a program, depending on the degree of transparency or what they want to see, I can't imagine that it would be less than a year.
Thank you.
But back to your question, we are looking at it, and I think that we were surprised by the number of comments that we received and the varying opinions from consumers, and certainly transparency was one of them. Last Friday, I appeared before House Labor and Commerce and asked that they introduced governor's bill for the Alaska Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association that I think you will see at some point. This is updating based on the National Association of Insurance Commissioners Model Act, Model 520. And the guarantee associations, in essence, step in to pay claims when an insurer fails financially, be it put into receivership, liquidation. Each state has a guarantee association. Alaska has two. We have a property and casualty guarantee association, and we have a life and health. We are asking to update the model, these particular provisions were enacted or adopted by the NAIC, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, in 2009. Alaska has not adopted this, so it's been 7 years. But we have also added one provision that is outside what the NAIC had. We are asking that the state add to the insurance company, or those that can be assessed to pay for these claims, hospital and medical service corporations. Now, when I'm talking hospital and medical service corporations, when an insurance company or someone that you would consider an insurance company comes into the state of Alaska to transact business, they file one of two ways. We have one as an insurance company or as a hospital or medical service corporation. We have one insurer, a large insurer, the only one in the individual market at this time that is filed as a hospital and medical service corporation. Our analysis is that if we had an insurer fail in the medical, we do not have enough remaining members to assess to pay claims. We had a pretty close call last year, so I think our data is pretty good on looking at if you have someone who has that big of a share of the market and they, you know, they're committed to Alaska the way Primera has been, but we just don't see how the Guarantee Association could function in the event. And we don't have an insolvency at this time. This is strictly looking forward, but just how we could function without their ability to assess. We're capped at 2% for assessments. Keep in mind that the association only assesses when they have claims. It's not forward, it's retrospect when an insurance company is placed in insolvency or in liquidation. But that is the other important change in this bill that we are asking for. And I know that Representative Keto said the bill would be drafted, so it will come, I'm sure, before this committee if and when it clears the House.
So that they would be subject to assessment.
Thank you for that. Are there any further comments you want to make in the remaining 5 minutes looking out onto the horizon of
of the broad topic of health care and the changes that we can expect to see?
The only thing that I think that we could tell you is that it is coming fast and furious out of D.C. We are reviewing a draft bill that was sponsored yesterday by Senator Cassidy and Senator Collins out of Maine. We are in contact with Senator Murkowski's office to working with her on how this bill would impact Alaskans. The Department of Health is also working on it. So we are both, for lack of a better word, swamped in what is coming out of D.C. because when they said they were going to hit it, they were not kidding. And we're trying to keep as abreast of what is going on and be able to make our comments back to our congressional delegation of what we think would be best for Alaska, or at least submit our comments to how this would impact Alaska overall and access to health care for all of us.
Any questions from committee members? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much for being here. And just to wrap up, we've heard from today from the tourism industry, also the air cargo industry or the airport, and we've also heard from the Division of Insurance related to health care and changes that we can expect. On Thursday, we will be hearing from Alaska's regional development organizations and their plans for an economic regional strategy that they put forward. And then we're going to ask the question, should the state have a state economic plan? And certainly we'll be hearing from the department on the work that you've done so far on this question. So with that, are there any closing comments from committee members? Okay, seeing none, we're adjourned, and thank you for coming.